Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Jillie Jeezy. This is Family Matters. Welcome. And, of course, we have Judge Michelle Laurance here with us this evening. How are you, Judge
Laurance? I'm in a great mood, obviously.
Well, I am so glad. Do you want to tell us why you're so happy tonight?
Well, I do. I really do. And I want to say something special to you, Jill, which you don't know is coming. But I was part of a seminar today on parental alienation in Cook County, which for those of you who listen overseas is the largest unified family law system in the world. So this was really important, and I was able to contribute a lot to this seminar because of the efforts of Jill Ajizi, because of you, Jill, because of how over the last 2 years you have brought to me the best minds on the subject, your experience, everything you know. I could have never been able to bring that information to these 200 lawyers were it not for you. I'm not trying to be corny, but I'm saying it like it is.
Thank you.
So you, Jill, have a reason to be, and I know you're up all night talking to people and researching and doing all this. There was a payoff this afternoon. There really was. The people were very interested. They were riveted. They stayed long past the sessions usually close with questions. They
Wow.
were getting it.
Well, that's terrific, Michelle. And you know, I never want to hear, I don't need accolades. This is about saving the souls of children. And if we made a difference today in Cook County, then that is going to kind of go out throughout the state of Illinois and really impact the lives of some children.
Well, I felt, you know, what I said to them, and I meant this from my heart. I didn't even know where this came from, but I knew almost everybody out there. And I said, when I look at each and every one of you, I see the child who you're going to make the difference for.
Oh, my.
Because once you know these skills, you can't forget them. Once you learn how to identify, it's just informationally. You know, superficial understanding is never enough here.
Well, and
that's
why we
devote a whole show to it.
I think it's interesting that when you did the judges training back in January, and I know you have another one coming up in April, I think it's interesting that when we talked, you know, you said it was, the room was quiet, everybody was really entranced with what you were telling them, as if this was new and innovative information that just came out. But this is something that's been around and is going to continue to be around unless we can get everybody to wake up and see that these children can't be used as weapons in adversarial divorce.
Well, there you go. And there's an important piece we're talking about tonight, a really important piece, which did come up today. And that important piece for all of you who are listening, our guest is going to talk about, along with many other things, reunification therapy, one of the major key tools. It's the plutonium of the tools. But we really need to understand what it is, how to get it, what to look for. We don't even know about it in where to get it in Cook County. I know one doctor, but we'll get to that.
Well, without further ado, let's not waste any more time talking about me, because God knows that's not in our show. So let's talk about Dr. Glenn Ross Caddy. He is a clinical and forensic psychologist, specialist in behavioral medicine. He's published books. He's authored professional journals. He's in Fort Lauderdale, my second home. Love that place. And he is nationally and internationally known. He's board certified in clinical psychology, forensic psychology, behavioral medicine, and human sexuality. He holds fellowship status in 3 out of 4 boards. He also is certified as a national custody evaluator. He is available for consults for families, attorneys, and forensic work. And later on, we'll give you his contact information. But he is one of the go-to people in the parental alienation arena. There's only a handful in the world, and Glenn is down there working it in Florida and internationally. So welcome, Glenn. Thanks for being here tonight.
Thank you very much, Jill.
We appreciate you so much, Glenn, and I know that you come across parental alienation as I do on a daily basis, and you are trying to make a difference in this world along with people like Richard Warshak and Craig Childress and all of the great people that Amy Baker that work in in this field. And we are so pleased that you would take time out tonight to share with our listeners what you know about parental alienation and all of the kind of different things that go along with it. So we want to start by talking about, we'll get to reunification in a second, but parental alienation is a form of mind control. And what some people don't understand who are just coming into this, can you talk to us about how does an alienator accomplish this very, very intricate brainwashing technique?
Well, I think there are probably two general classes of alienator. That is the profound spokesperson, the incredibly angry person, who is not to determine. I mean, it'll pass.
You know what, Glenn? I'm losing you on that headset. It's breaking up right now.
I can't hear either.
I know. You were doing really great before, but I'm losing you right now.
All right. What about this?
Better. Okay.
Okay, fine. Okay. So, again, what I was saying is that there are the type of alienators who are incredibly angry, really quite pathological, and prepared prepared to do almost anything not to maintain control of the situation. And one of the best ways of trying to maintain control of the situation and injure and punish the other parent is to take the children or attempt control and take the children. Now, sometimes that person sets about to take all of the children. Sometimes they simply target one child and give that child such special attention that that child separates from the others. And you tend to see that happening more when there's a substantial age gap between the child that's being alienated and the others. Normally the others are younger. And the other sort of alienator is the person who is not necessarily so intentionally malicious, but is incompetent and simply slowly, subtly changes the metric and constantly is undermining and provokes some of the sort of things that slowly lead to alienation also. But the nature of the alienation is often almost complete and often profound in the case of the first category of alienator. In the second category of alienation, they may do a reasonable job at it, but probably not with the same level of consummate success, if you like, as the more pathological individuals. And often those very pathological individuals are able to partly hide their pathology because they are otherwise very powerful in maybe the workplace that they have or in various sorts of circumstances. And yet, to the rest, to many people in the rest of the world, they will not present themselves in that light, and they will fight to argue that they are the, you know, they are the perfect parent, and the other person is, you know, very negative, et cetera, et cetera. The bottom line, though, is irrespective of the class of the alienator, ultimately they all do the following things. They seek to align themselves with the child and the child with them or the children with them. They seek to degrade the other parent and develop a belief in the child that her or his own earlier knowledge or impressions or beliefs or remembrances were in fact invalid, and that he or she never loved mother, or mother never loved him, or father never loved him or her. And so, what starts off as an injection of support and abnormal closeness becomes increasingly a series of messages and signals that are designed specifically to cause the child to align and to develop belief systems about the other parent, which are not only pathological, well, they're not only inaccurate, but they become pathological in that often what happens is the child learns to believe alleged facts that never existed and truths that have never been in regard to the parent who is now becoming alienated. And you see that only too often. In fact, one of the distinctions between the concept of parental and alienation and a lesser condition called estrangement, is that in the case of estrangement, for example, there'll often have been the recognition of a prior good relationship, and then things happen. In the case of an alienation state, the child will often come to believe that there was never a prior good relationship, and that things like, for example, that the alleged alienating parent would abuse or neglect them, or favor the other children, or engage in other behaviors that simply didn't ever take place. And of course, all of the time, the alienator building him or herself up to be the safety zone for the child and the protector of the child, the white knight, if you like, who's going to protect the child from, the evils of this other party. And in the process of that, the evolution of this, what you literally develop is a delusional disorder in the child.
I want to ask you something. Is there different strategies that a parent uses depending upon the age of the child? Developmentally, are there things that we should know about younger children versus implanting or doing mind control with teenagers?
It is much more difficult if there's a long history of affecting loving relationship with a child who, and the divorce hits in early teen years, it is much, much more difficult for an alienator to succeed. Now, that doesn't mean they don't, but statistically, the children who are relatively younger, when the alienation takes place, say 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, are children who are more likely to be much more completely alienated than if the alienation starts at 13, 14, 15, because the child at age 14 or 15 has other good experiences, and it takes a lot more to cause that child to tip. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't or that they won't. It just means that they have to come to believe, an older child has to come to believe that some evil deeds have also taken place. For example, something that will sometimes trigger the alienator and will facilitate his or her work is if the other partner begins a new relationship or separates from one parent and seeks a new relationship. Betrayal of the marriage or the presumption of betrayal of the marriage will often be used very cruelly by the alienating parent who will succeed in developing a connectedness because they were holier than the other one in the sense that they will allege that they weren't the one that you know that left the marriage. But young children are much more damaged and more readily induced into that delusional state.
Michelle and Glenn, I want to just grab a call. We have a caller, and I'm going to grab that right now. Welcome, 630 area code. What's your name?
My name is David.
Hi, David. Do you have a question for Dr. Caddy?
I do. I just want to commend him. I've heard many good things through a bunch of our agencies that are in Florida, and he's done numerous good things. My question to him is, I do have a 9 and a 14-year-old that is typically, they've been Munchausened, and more so with a collaboration of a child rep and the mother that's a psychologist, or she's actually a social worker, and then directly get it from the child rep to say that he is definitely going to make sure that they alienate me from my children, which they've successfully done. And now I have tried to go back with a forensic psychologist I've been working with, and there's no communication directly between the child rep and my forensic psychologist to get anything going. And then when I go to court, I get condescended from this child rep, and I ask him point blankly, you know, you gave me my word, your word, that you would foster a relationship back.
So, David, what's your question for Dr. Caddy?
My question, bottom line, is that how do you deal with, on a level that the cards are stacked against me regardless? They did the typical ISBA order of protection against me, and they flipped the cards where I was the primary caregiver for the first 12 years, and she became the rescuer, and they vilified me.
Yes.
Okay, David, I'm going to let Dr. Caddy answer that. Thank you for calling, okay?
Yes.
Well, David, obviously any advice that would be given over a show like this is not necessarily adequate professional advice, because in order to offer that sort of advice, I'd firstly need to have done a critical analysis that I simply haven't done. But one of the things that is often required in a situation like this is a fair bit of courage on your part, and courage to really confront the issue. Now, the child rep, what discipline is that child rep from? Meaning, is it a mental health provider? Is it a lawyer? Who is it?
Oh, hang on. He's calling back. Hang on just a second. David,
right.
Where is that? Where is that? Did you hear the question Dr. Caddy asked?
Yes. The attorney?
I'm asking, who is the child rep? What discipline is the child rep?
What discipline?
Is she a mental health professional or attorney?
Oh, no. He's profaned that he has a degree in social work, and on his card, it's pretty deceiving. He's an attorney.
Interesting.
You know what? For fear of being retaliated more against, because my case is so politically, it's been driven to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I can't really.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I understand. Well, let me make a couple of general statements. When one of the things that you often have in these cases, and your case unfortunately is all too boringly common, is that you will have a really incompetent person, either a guardian ad litem, and it doesn't matter whether that person's a social worker or a lawyer or whoever they are, if they aren't really knowledgeable in the field, it's very easy to sort of, you know, make a mistake, and people do it all the time. And so one of the things that I've sometimes encouraged people to do is take a specific action against the person, and do that by going to their licensing authority, whether it be the bar or whether it be the you know, the licensing body that licenses psychologists or mental health providers or whatever in your state, and use your forensic psychologist or retain one for the purpose specifically of helping you develop the critical evidence of either the bias or the failure to use appropriate process of critical analysis in that situation. Because although the court who's appointed that person may well have an interest in not disconnecting that person, if this case is going to drag on for quite some time, the licensing body may well give a totally separate look at this situation. And that is something that I've been successful in a couple of cases where we knocked the person off the perch by going through a licensing authority, which then accused them of, you know, questionable practice, and in one case proceeded to actually go against them, and that was very effective in court. That did get the attention of the judge, who then realized, oh my goodness, I've been listening to the wrong party here.
Great. David, thank you for calling. We appreciate your call, and I hope this helped. And continue your pursuit. Never, ever give up, okay?
I just want to reiterate one thing to him. This is Illinois. I complained to the ARDC like 15 times already. It's gone to the Illinois Supreme Court. I'm to the point right now where I know there's no justice in Illinois, and I'm to the point where I'm going to give up my parental rights because I can't fight this kind of injustice. And in family court in Illinois, especially in Crook County, there is no justice. And I appreciate you taking my call, and I really appreciate everything you're doing, and keep doing it. Thank you. Have a great
day. Thanks, David. Michelle, you might just want to address that.
I would say that David had a horrendous experience. I don't know anything. I can't really comment on that. I know that what I saw today was a lot of judges and a lot of child reps. And granted, they really were not up to speed. And as Dr. Katie says, a lot of mistakes can be made. I agree with that. And
well, I think I'm
pretty sure I've made some.
But the unfortunate part is there's so many people like me, like all of the parents who've been in this parental alienation arena for so long, that the things we're doing now are not, there's not going to make a difference for these parents or for their children because they're all grown and gone. But what you're doing and what we're trying to do here in Illinois, we do so many things wrong in Illinois. We're getting this right now. Family, court, just revision and judicial education is happening here. And for all of the bad press that we get, this is something that other states are looking to us for. And I think that's exciting.
It is exciting. And I know that people on the bench and in the bar have made mistakes. There's no question about it. As I said, I am certain that before I had this information and the nuances and how deep you have to go into it to understand it, I'm sure that I made mistakes. But I would say that people have made mistakes as a result of not knowing. I honestly do not believe it's corrupted. That's what I want to say. I really don't. I think the offense is the unintentional offense.
Glenn?
Yeah, the other comment that I wanted to make was that I would encourage this caller and other people listening in to never give up. And I don't mean by that that you might not have to ultimately stop the legal fight or stop, but life is a lot longer than the first 20 years. And if you may have lost a number of years of childhood, which is devastating, but, you know, people grow up, and sometimes what happens is they get involved with another person who is actually a really good person, and that really good person starts asking them questions about their childhood, And sometimes that really good person becomes a bridge to facilitate a long overdue reconciliation. So I would never encourage somebody to just surrender to the impossible pain that they're experiencing and say, this is it. It's when you die, not before.
Right. Well said. It was just kind of why we wrote the workbook, because we wanted to give a tool for people on hanging on by their fingertips off the cliff to how to hold on, how not to give up. That's kind of why we did that.
I'm involved in a case at the moment. The father lives in Arizona, and he has children in Arizona and California. And all of those children are now in their 30s. And he gets a Father's Day card from a granddaughter who he's never met, because the father of the wife who was alienated, the girl who was alienated, is encouraging that behavior. What I'm doing at the moment is working with a grandparent of the mother, of the child, to try and facilitate an introduction that will get us an opportunity to start work now that should have happened 10 or 12, 13 years ago.
Interesting. Well, can we, when I spoke to you on the phone before, we were talking about, we had an hour, almost 2 hour long seminar today, and I had asked, there was about 200 child representatives, if any of them had heard of reunification therapy, and sadly, not many had. So can you really start to break it down for us? What really goes on there? What happens, and how do we find somebody who can do that?
Well, there are really very few people who are trained in it, and the reason for that is that the nature of this work in reunification is a little bit like the deprogramming that sometimes you find experts, for example, in the CIA and in the FBI, who are used to working with deprogramming of people who've been, sort of captured in by foreign entities, and who've been converted. In reunification therapy, there is in fact a lot of restructuring linked to mind control, and in most instances, the very best. Often you can't have an ideal world, but one element of the ideal world that I would argue for in reunification therapy is a very intense program. Doesn't have to be inpatient. It can be on an outpatient day program basis, where the therapist, or perhaps sometimes even two therapists if it's a large family, if there are five children or something, where what they do is they start with one child at a time, and before they try and reintroduce the relationship, they need to develop a relationship with the child that is trusting, and they need to know enough about the entire situation so that they can bring various people to bear to communicate with the child in their presence. And those people could be uncles, aunts, grandparents, friends of the family, people whose perspective is aligned with the alienated parent generally, and who have facts, and who can bring such a level of evidence to bear in dealing with this child, such that the child's ability to sustain the argument that was their conviction starts to break down. And I've found that using just trying to get the child to simply buy into the parent's the alienated parents scenario can be a very difficult task. But let me tell you some things that can help. Family photographs and albums. Stories that the child will remember. Stories told by other relatives that the child will remember. But when you see, for example, often a highly alienated child will believe that the alienated parent is evil, that they never loved them, that they never loved them, that neither loved each other, and that they never had any good times together. They absolutely, that's how serious the mind control can be. Now, I'm talking about profound cases. I'm not just talking about lesser levels of alienation, because there's an entire progression of alienation all the way up to psychosis. But at these higher levels, evidence that comes in where you can bring family photos and albums together that just make a mockery of the premise of the belief systems of the alienated child is often a very good place to start in starting to crack the convictions that characterize that the alienated child's relationship with the parent who has been alienated, the parent victim. And there's a lot of people who say, well, do family therapy. No, you don't. You don't do family therapy in the earlier stages, because in the early stages, you may have two or three children all very substantially alienated. And what are you going to do in family therapy? Listen to them rail on the other person who says, that's not true, that's not true. If they're really alienated, they do not believe the other person. So what you have to do is you in essence have to desensitize them from their belief systems through a line of evidence that's so compelling that they are forced to degrade their own arguments. Their cognitions have to change in exactly the same way as people who want to, how do you successfully treat a person who, you know, has gone to a program to be a jihadist? It's a mind control conversion. And in these young children, the case is almost as complicated. And so you start with individual therapy, where you bring a lot of resources together. You use whatever good evidence can be made available, whether it be photographs or friends of the family, et cetera, and you do it slowly.
Glenn, how long would you say, I mean, in a successful case that you can think back on, how long would you say from getting a severely alienated child, and let's just talk about one child, because my goodness, one severely alienated child is like an army. So just getting that child to the point where they can sit in a room and actually talk to the target parent, what kind of walk us through that?
Well, it could be as little as, if it's relatively intensive care, you know, maybe three or four times a week for several hours at a time, maybe even half a day at a time. We can typically accelerate it by the volume of care, but it would not be unreasonable for it to take 3 to 5 weeks before.
So you would say it would be as easy to deprogram these kids as it was to program them?
I think it is probably more difficult to deprogram them, because the programmer worked so hard that they have to be brought from pathology, whereas before they weren't pathological and they had to be brought into pathology.
Okay.
So I think that the road out is probably, but the good news is that the road out can be accelerated by relatively intensive care. The other issue is that you cannot succeed in accelerating this alienation so long as you have the alienated parent actively in the mix with them. The last thing in the world you need is the alienated parent in the room in a family therapy session. We need to understand, and the courts need to understand, that these alienators are not simply normal misguided souls. They are truly pathological. And to treat them as if they're all just slightly misguided souls and that they really do want to do the right thing is to miss out entirely the fact that some of them are really sociopathic. They don't give a damn. You know, it's all about them and their ability to control.
And what would a proper diagnosis be for these kinds of people?
They tend to be relatively intelligent. They tend to be highly manipulative. Sometimes they move all the way to sociopathy. I know that both of you have read an article that I wrote called The Continuum of Alienation.
Yeah.
At the lesser levels, when the child is only mildly to moderately alienated, you often just have, you know, rather inadequate, personality disorders, a poorly framed personality in the alienating parent, and you have a lot of dependency needs and inadequacies, and so the alienating parent will strive to prove their worth through the eyes of the child through capturing them. But in the most extreme cases, you have truly sociopathic behavior. Give a damn if the victim parent dies. In fact, be really quite happy to have it happen. So get these extremes at the far end. Now, at the far end, it might take literally months, because there's typically going to be at least one child who's more programmed than the others, and often that child is the oldest child, because that child then keeps all of the others within the system. If there's a family of three or four, for example.
Boy, just to hear you say this just brings back such horrible memories, you know, with four children and the oldest being the one who was the most divisive in the system.
Yep.
I, Glenn, where were you when I needed you? Where have you been all my life?
I'm involved in a deprogramming situation with a case up in Orlando, Florida at the moment. There are five children in this family. The oldest girl is now 18,
mm-hmm.
so she is literally reached majority, and the father has spent in excess of $1 million over 10 years, five lawyers, four judges, and he still does not have access to the children.
I have a question to ask you. One of them is going to be the exact protocol, and does the alienating parent ever get involved, and when does that happen? And the okay,
yep.
We'll do that one first.
The alienating parent will get involved in the process because, you know, the way this gets set up is that the children have to, you know, it's a little bit like, you know, when let's say when a parent is alcoholic and, you know, the children can't avoid the fact that their mother or their father is alcoholic. Even you can try and keep the truth away from them, but eventually they're going to know. And then it's a question of what we do, really define it to be. And once the children come to understand this, then the person who's been the alienator finds themselves in the very strange position of having lost a great deal of power all of a sudden. And sometimes that parent is so pathological themselves that they will, in essence, say, to hell with it. You know, you're all wrong. I'm right. Get lost. And that person will withdraw. If on the other hand, they are not that controlling, that they can't deal with the loss of ego integrity that losing brings, what they will do is they will need to have their own clinician who works with the deprogramming clinician to slowly introduce them to the children under controlled and secure terms, and where a condition of the reestablishment of the relationship has to be certain concessions by that alienating parent. And you know what? The problem is that if that person is pathological enough, they will never give you those conditions.
Well,
and sometimes what you do is you wait for the youngest child to reach 18 and then say, well, you know, I'll still support you, but to some degree it's up to you now, son or daughter, whether you wish to have a relationship with your father and on what terms. I know that he loves you. I also know that he's crazy. Or I know that your mother loves you and she's, you know, she's got some problems. I encourage you to try, but by the same token, I encourage you perhaps to consider being involved in some therapy while you're doing it, just so that you can keep your balance.
Is there a APA formal protocol for reunification therapy?
Not at this time.
So how do you find, is a family systems therapist enough? What's the screening process to find the right therapist? And let's say that it isn't where somebody lives, doesn't exist. What's the next best thing, if at all?
I think that what you can do is, I think there is a solution to this. And that is, the first thing that you need, irrespective, is a very skilled clinician. Now, if that clinician isn't experienced in this particular dimension, and virtually none of them are, I would say probably less than 1 in 1,000 clinicians has ever experienced doing this sort of work. Very, very rare. And it's not because the problems aren't there, it's just because often the alienator wins, and therefore the children, therefore there isn't a reconciliation. But what can happen is that the person needing this special help, the parent victim, can find their own really skilled clinician. In that regard, I'd be looking for somebody who is board certified in clinical psychology, who had a lot of family systems experience, and who could link to an expert. Because there's absolutely no reason, for example, why if I'm dealing with an extremely experienced clinician, why I can't be a consultant. And I'm not trying to say me per se, but there are some experts around the country in parental alienation who have had the sort of experience in this that allows them to be able to mentor clinicians in other parts of the country. And guess what? One of the things that we have available to us these days is video conferencing capacities, and so that it might even be possible for the treating clinician expose the expert to some of the therapeutic process that they're engaging in through video conference, and continue to build pointers and work with the person who truly is experienced, as opposed to flying the people out to, you know, to come and see somebody like myself. But the chances of it working without that level of expert support is really not good, because the person is operating in the blind. They just don't know enough to know exactly what road, you know, what pitfalls they're going to face at various points along.
And I think, Glenn, what you just said is so important. If we could get people like you and people like Richard Warshak to train other people all around the country, then you can drive the problem with a lot of people who – and this is a priceless thing, reunification, but it is so utterly expensive to do. And at the point where reunification maybe is ordered by a judge, it's so difficult to pay the price, because you've exhausted everything you have financially to get to that point.
Absolutely.
And if we can get the supply and demand sort of worked out, and your training and Richard's training, and we've got people all over the country that we can go to for this, then it's a little more palatable for people who have financially exhausted themselves.
Yes, and unfortunately, even when we look for things like medical insurance to help, as we all know, medical insurance tends not to cover mental health services anywhere near as well as it should, despite the fact that there are federal laws dealing with parity. So absolutely you're right. By the time many people that I come across, by the time we start thinking about rehabilitation therapy, in many cases, people have virtually every dime that they have available in just fighting the legal process.
How expensive will insurance pick up any of it, or because it's not in the DSM-4, it won't?
No, that's really not an issue at all. The fact that parental alienation syndrome is not specifically listed in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual doesn't mean that it won't, and the reason for that is as follows. Many of these children and the parent are suffering collateral that, PAS, parental alienation syndrome, is the outcome of a process, but there are a number of elements within that syndrome that include delusional disorder, depression, anger, a variety of distortions of thought, and so any of those issues are relevant to, would be targeted behaviors for change in the delivery of mental health care, and certainly in the case of the parent who's been alienated, stress, anxiety disorders, depression, all of the above. Anger, the point is that there are a number of conditions that are a part of this entire constellation of chaos. And those are going to be treated anyway. And so it may well be that the primary diagnosis for different children will be slightly different. Some of them may be very withdrawn. Some of them may be going through withdrawal because, after all, in the process of recovery from that distorted belief system, there's a lot of conflict that person has to go through, and often a lot of pain and a lot of confusion.
Are you saying some of it could be by insurance?
I'm saying if a person has health insurance that has reasonably good health coverage, probably a small percentage of it could be, yes.
Glenn, what would you say in Broward County, which is where Fort Lauderdale is, would you say you are reunification is ordered on a regular basis when parental alienation cases come up? Or what's the percentage there?
Despite the fact that this is not an unsophisticated county,
right,
as far as the law is concerned, I would say that it's almost non-existent.
So how many cases a year would you say you get? And I know you do, you're international and national. Nationally, how many cases a year would you say are referred to you or come to you by some means?
Well, if I just think about actual cases that I get involved in, I'm probably involved in about and where I do most of the work, probably about 40 a year. If, on the other hand, and sometimes I bring in other clinicians, but if you're asking me how many cases do I get asked to have a consult on or asked questions about or asked would I be willing to take the case,
mm-hmm,
probably 3 a week, 4 a week.
What do we have to know as judges and lawyers and litigants about what kind of treatment to give the child when there's a transfer of custody, which could be very traumatic, as we can imagine?
Well, I think that what I would always encourage is for the child to be given for a skilled clinician to be given the responsibility of doing an evaluation of that child and making specific recommendations to the court. And the reason for that is that, you know, there is all too often a very, you know, devoted and interested and caring judge who will simply appoint somebody, but, you know, appointing somebody doesn't mean that that the right person is going to be appointed. One of the interesting things in Broward County is that there's a person I know who gets routinely appointed by the court, but the person is anything but skilled. But because various judges have mentioned this person's name, and they just, this person gets, you know, a lot of business, and you know, there are people who just stand off on the sidelines and scratch their head with, you know, with bemusement, who are in the profession.
Well, what do we say to judges who say, like at the seminar today, somebody raised their hand and said, well, what about that case where the child did kill themselves? You know, these are the severe cases.
And I said
there's always going to be a terrible case, but we cannot use that as a barometer.
The
lesser cases will not get help. What happens to the child? Tell us something about what we need to know on a transfer of custody.
I think that when you're talking about transfer of custody, you almost always need to have a really skilled clinician in the mix. And what I would sometimes recommend is that if there's been a prior therapist involved, that when you go to either reunification or where you go to change of custody, you give serious consideration to getting another therapist involved, perhaps somebody who will consult with the prior therapist, but you want that person not to be tarnished by maybe their prior involvements as, for example, a forensic specialist. You know, you need to make a clear distinction between a forensic specialist who's offering an opinion about the interest of the child to a person who's providing treatment to the child, and they should not be the same people. So sometimes, you know, courts just sort of say, well, so and so can do the work because he or she knows about the case, but that creates ethics issues or potential ethics issues. Not for the legal system, but for the healthcare professional. I think that inevitably a child of this situation needs to be examined. And again, you get the difficulty that sometimes these people are financially absolutely strapped in regard to this. And you know, there's a vast difference between buying a $10,000 car and buying a $100,000 car, so too there's a vast difference between clinicians with different levels of training. And sometimes, you know, a bad clinician or an ill-trained clinician can do a great deal of harm, not a great deal of good.
Well, let's transfer custody on Wednesday, because you make the finding as a judge that it has to happen right away.
Yes.
And by the time you get this entire protocol in place, as a judge, you need it all in place right before you make your finding. I guess I answered my own question.
I think that's right, Your Honor. I think that the court has to be sensitive to the need to make sure that all of the data that the court needs to maximize the protection for the process is in place, as opposed to hanging it out there later on, because often, and especially in the case where one of the parents may be in a position to pay for all of this, and the other parent may not be, and if even that sort of issue isn't sorted out, that can just sort of drag things on endlessly and cause, you know, people to go around in circles.
We've got a caller I'm going to grab really quick. Hi, caller. What's your name?
Hello, how are you?
Fine. Do you have a question for Dr. Caddy?
Yes. The question is that 5 years ago, it was seemed a little forward for people to ask one another for an AIDS test, for instance, before they started dating or getting intimate, and now it's commonplace. And I would think that in 10 to 15 years, couples are going to sit down and discuss how they're going to raise children if they split up and what parameters they're going to follow, because it's becoming so prevalent in families.
Thank you for your question, caller. Glenn, can you answer that?
I'm not sure I can answer it. I think it's a great question. If we can make a decision about how we're going to distribute assets through a prenuptial, it might be a good idea if we thought about what we might do in the event of the interest of children earlier on. And of course, that would be a very fascinating thing to do, because one of the things that happens is that, we just don't think about getting divorced and we don't think about the impact of children when we're in the process of, falling for somebody or getting married. But if there was sort of a prenuptial on children, and you had to have incredibly compelling reasons to vary that, it might be an interesting way of cutting through disarming some of the orientation towards alienation. I'm not saying it would stop any of the anger, but it might make it more difficult for the process to be successful, because the courts would maybe be able to go and look at the prenuptial agreement around children and be persuaded that it would require compelling evidence to vary that, just as is true that it takes compelling evidence to vary a prenuptial agreement around finances.
Interesting question, caller, and great answer, Glenn. We have about 3 minutes left, and I don't want to leave without getting your contact information out there, because there are people who may be able to give you a call, and you may be able to help them, and that's what our goal is here on this show. So, Glenn, how can people reach you?
Well, they can reach me through my office number, which is 954-565-8850. They can also reach me by simply emailing me. My name is Glenn Caddy, GlennCaddy, @gmail.com. Or they can Google me, and they won't have any trouble finding me.
That's for sure. Michelle, any closing comments for Glenn?
Well, thank you very, very much for... I'm telling you, the cylinders are clicking in my brain like castanets. I'm trying to think of how we can get some training up here. I'm sorry. I'm like already there, because I'm telling you, there were 200 child reps today who are saying, "So what do we do now? Who do we go to?"
Yeah.
No, scratching their head, and they were open to all the kind of help and perspective that went on today. So let's talk again, the three of us, and see what we can do.
Let's do it. And maybe even get them a copy of this show for food for thought for them, Michelle.
Well, that's a good idea.
One last comment I'd like to make, and that is that we were actually, before the show, we were talking about doing some work that dealt with issues around grandparents. We don't have time to deal with that now, but that's something that's very important and is becoming more and more significant all of the time. So that's something that we might want to talk about on another occasion.
Absolutely, Glenn, and I'd love to invite you back. I'll get with you tomorrow, and we'll pick some dates, and we will do a show revolving around grandparents, because we really intended to do that tonight. So let's do that, and I just appreciate you and everything you do and your time with us here tonight. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Glenn, and bye, Jill. Have a good week.
Well, bye, everybody. And I wanted to just remind everybody that Michelle and I have Parental Alienation 911, and you can find us at parentalalienation911.net. And if you need a workbook that's going to help you travel this journey of parental alienation, we've got it out there for you. It's the only workbook written by a sitting family court judge and an advocate. So take a look. If you don't like it, don't buy it. We think it's something that will really help you.
Also, we forgot to tell everybody that Speaker of the House Madigan signed the bill. Jill, you want to announce
it? Yeah, sure. House Resolution 724, and we now have Parental Alienation Awareness Month in Illinois in the month of April, so that's so exciting. So,
fantastic.
Yeah, so everybody can celebrate.
At least in large part, thanks to you, Jill. So thank you.
Thank you. And Glenn, have a great night. Michelle, you too, and we'll talk to you soon.
Have a great night, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye, all.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.